This is the Careering into Motherhood podcast, and I'm Jane Johnson, founder of Careering into Motherhood. Through our coaching programs, masterclasses, the community of 7,000 women over on our Facebook group, and this podcast, we aim for a world where motherhood and ambition can happily coexist. For more information about all the support we offer, including coaching programs and masterclasses, please see our website, www.careeringintomotherhood.com, or find us on Facebook. Just look for the group Careering into Motherhood. I wanted to do an episode about the effects that music and art can have on us in times of stress. It's been a terrible year for so many people, and yet lots of us have found solace and comfort in new things that we didn't know we needed before this year, whether that's been gardening or a new hobby or walking. I know lots of people have taken up running who never thought they would ever be runners, things that we didn't really have the time for before. From a very personal point, my mother has been seriously ill for the last 2 years. She's defied all the odds and coped with the grueling treatment regimes, supported and cared for always by my dad. From my earliest memories, though, my mum was passionate to the point of obsession about singing and her choir. She sung at the Royal Albert Hall and all over the world. There's a bit of a family myth that my first sentence was apparently, "Mummy's gone singing." But in these last 2 years, her choir has provided more than just the joy of music. It's been so much more. It's been pain relieving, and I honestly believe it's also been life supporting. So in honour of my mum, this episode is an interview with two women who know firsthand how music and art can lift us up and provide comfort and solace in times of great pain. My first guest is Gemma Francis, who founded The Big Sing with her husband nearly 10 years ago now. Gemma, thank you very much for agreeing to do this, especially at such short notice. And I know you've just had to carry off your poor little baby, or your husband has, into another room. But I really wanted to talk to you about all your work with The Big Sing. So can you talk a little bit about how you came to set it up? Because it wasn't a result of the pandemic, was it?
No, we've been going now for nearly 10 years. We started just as a little community project. Me and my husband are musicians. We toured around the world. I used to sing for the London Community Gospel Choir. And my husband toured with people like Westlife, Blue, Will Young. And at the time, we were just so busy touring and just going from one place to the other that we just thought, we just had like a calling really, just to do something for our local community. And so we thought we'd set up a choir in the community, just a little 6-week project, get everyone singing, and it would be just like a really nice thing to do. So that's what we did, and we called it The Big Sing, and 45 people came together in that time. And during that time, we really saw that it was just more than a choir. You know, people were making new friendships. They were telling us stories of how the music was helping them get through illnesses and depression and loneliness. And during those 6 weeks, the choir really bonded and we did our performance and everything was great. And then the choir said to us at the end, "You can't stop here. You've got to carry on. We found something amazing." And so we just carried on, really. And before we knew it, the next town along had heard what we were doing and they wanted to start a choir. So we started a choir there and it just grew organically. And, you know, the parents, they wanted something for the kids. So we started Little Sing for the kids. They did kids' choirs. And then some other mums wanted something for their babies and we did Tiny Sing for the babies. And now, 10 years later, we have choirs all across Essex, Kent, Suffolk, London, the Midlands. And we just try and get music out to as many people as possible. So not only is it community choirs and kids choirs and baby groups, but now we go into offices and do office choirs and get the staff motivated. We go into disabled groups and get them singing. We work with people with Alzheimer's, lots of different things, and just trying to get everybody singing, because singing is so good for everybody's mental health and it just brings people together and it just unifies people. So that's our journey, really.
Absolutely amazing story. I love it. And why is it? What is it about singing that you think gets people? Why is it such a stress reliever and so good for mental health?
It's amazing for mental health because, you know, it gives people an escape. You know, they come together for 2 hours or whatever it is a week and they can just sing and release it. Singing is great at releasing a lot of tension, a lot of stress. and it just releases things. You know, you can just sing your heart out, forget about the troubles of the world and what's going on. And I've had so many of our choir members say, you know, it's helped them get through their cancer treatments or whatever treatments they're having, what illnesses they're going through. Their doctors have actually said to them, what are you doing? And they said, well, I'm just singing in a choir. And they said, wow, it's really helping your recovery. So it really does. It really just lifts people.
Yeah. And I'm not a medic, as listeners will well know, but I'm sure I've read something that there is something to do. Singing, the part of the brain that it's in or something, yeah, is close to pain reliever and things like that.
Yeah. And it releases endorphins. So when you're singing, that all helps.
Definitely. And so have you seen kind of more people driven to your services and things during this pandemic? Or how have you moved things? What obviously things have massively changed for you. Choirs can't get together.
Yeah, it's been tricky. It's been difficult for us as a business to get through this time because obviously the government says that you can't actually sing at the moment. So everything was just put on hold and stopped overnight. So during lockdown, we decided to put everything online and get people online singing with us from their front rooms, which has been great. You know, the choir members have jumped on, and every week we have 2 rehearsals a week, and we've tried to pick the most uplifting songs we can find just to say, keep going, guys. We're going to get through this. It might seem like tough at the moment. Lockdown is hard on all of us, but the songs really speak for themselves. They're really uplifting songs. And, you know, we even feel the benefit of doing it online. You know, when we, after we've done rehearsal, we feel uplifted ourselves. So just to have that opportunity to still keep singing, even though it's online and everyone's singing to their computers in their front rooms, but it's still just the opportunity to sing, which has been great.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, who would have ever thought 12 months ago that I'd be talking to someone whose business has got people singing into their computers? But, you know, it's been a funny old year. And so do you think, let's hope this vaccine really makes an impact and, you know, we can get back to the new normal. Will you keep some online sessions going, or are people, you know, really craving getting back together in their choirs?
Yeah, I think the majority are really craving just to get back and to be able to see people and hear each other, because online you obviously can't hear each other sing. So they are really craving that. They're craving human connection. And when you're singing in a choir, you hear everybody singing around you, and that's all part of the choir experience. And when we're singing online, obviously you just hear yourself and you hear me and my husband singing, and that's it. But the good side of it is that we are able now to reach out to people across the country in locations where we hadn't been before. So they've joined us online, and perhaps there isn't a big sing in their area, but now they can be connected to us and they can sing with us and they can still learn the songs with us. So I think there will be an element where we do stay online, maybe once a week, for people who do want to continue in that way. But the majority are really craving to get back to some kind of normality.
Yeah. And I know when we spoke briefly before this interview, you talked about the choir family. And I think, well, perhaps you can talk a bit about that. It really does bind people who, you know, people from all different walks of life who come together.
Yeah, definitely people that probably wouldn't have met before. Different ages, different backgrounds, different cultures, different religions. Everybody in the community, basically, music is one of those things that it's like a universal language. You don't have to be an amazing singer. You just have to have the enthusiasm to want to try. And we found that has broken barriers. It's created new friendships between people. And that's why they call themselves a family, because they go through this experience together. They rehearse songs together. They have new challenges together. They do performances together. And all of that really bonds them as a group. And, you know, they call it their choir family. We didn't even say that at the beginning, but they came to us and said, that choir, this isn't just a choir, this is family.
That's so nice. That's lovely. And so do you do concerts and things with your choirs?
Yeah, we do loads of things. So we have different performances. So sometimes we go into the community and we sing at like local village fetes or carnivals, those kind of things. And then we do big Christmas shows, usually, obviously not this year. We do a big fest every year where all the choirs come together under one roof and they have workshops during the day. They do a big concert in the evening. So we have like different kinds of things that the choir members can choose what they want to come to. But we just want to sing in every situation we can. So we just look for every opportunity to sing.
I love it. I'd love to come around for dinner.
Yeah, you should do.
And I mean, so I'm now sort of more interested in kind of the business side of it and how you got it up and running. I mean, it must take some incredible organizing it, and you're doing it, obviously, as you said, your husband's still touring with bands and things, and you've got, is it one or two young kids?
I've got three.
Oh, three. My God. Three, you're doing all of this around, yeah, three children.
Yeah.
God. But you still, how does it work? Do you employ people? How do you organise everything?
Yeah. So now we have a team. Obviously, when we started, well, we only had one child at the time. So the family's grown along with the business. But yes, we've built our team up over the last few years. So we've got tutors now that help us. I've got an office manager that helps to do all my admin for me. And without them, we just wouldn't be able to do it, because me and my husband, we were just at full capacity doing all the choirs. I was doing all the admin, all the marketing and everything. But he basically focuses on the musical side, puts all the songs together, all the arrangements, and does most of the choirs. And I'm the business side. So I'm the one that started it all from that angle, do all the marketing, get the word out there, tell people what's happening. But we both teach. So I'm the one that would go into schools and do all the kids and everything. So it's just been organically growing. And, you know, we've built our team around the growth. And it got to a point where we grew so much in Essex that we decided that me and my husband were going to come up to the Midlands. And now we're based in Rugby, but we've left the team in Essex to continue.
Oh, amazing.
So, yeah. So it's quite a big change. We actually changed our whole lives. We moved our family, our home, so we could be up here, so we could start choirs up here and just grow up here.
Fantastic. So you're sort of moving around the country and leaving choirs of people behind. That's just brilliant. It's been hard enough in lockdown working in the same office space as my husband, let alone working in the same business with three kids and running your own business like that.
Yeah, we do get on really well. And to be honest, we met while we were working, because I was singing for London Community Gospel Choir. He was playing for them. So we met in that situation anyway. We've always got on really well. We bounce off each other. So for us, it's our dream situation, because we just want to work together, live together, have family together as well. So it's great for us.
That's so nice. It's really, really brilliant. So how can people find out more about you? Because I'm sure there'll be loads of people listening going, well, I've always fancied myself as a bit of a singer, or I just need some kind of stress relief. How can people find out more?
Go to the website, which is www.big-sing.com. Or you can find us on Facebook. Just look up The Big Sing. Obviously, at the moment, we're online totally. Hopefully next year we can get all of our choirs back physically and rebuild the company.
Amazing. I think we should have a careering in some other... We just did a comedy night. I think we should have a singing night led by you and your husband.
Definitely. That would be fantastic.
Hi, my name's Cathy Murray. I haven't got the best singing voice, but that's never stopped me singing. And that didn't stop me joining my local community choir in Stretford, Manchester, which is run by the amazing Hannah Newcombe, who does it all for the love of it. When there's 30 to 40 of you singing together, you can miss the odd high note or low note. You cover for each other. And it's that sense of having each other's back and being part of something that is the real kick to being in a choir for me. We all do it for fun and to make us feel good. And in lockdown, I needed that feeling more than ever. It became 1 hour per week where I could escape and I could forget about being cooped up at home, forget about homeschooling or the pressures of work, and just feel really connected with others in my community. The thought of everyone in their kitchen or wherever they were at home, propping up their phones against whatever they were leaning them against and singing their hearts out, helped me get through the weeks and I guess feel hopeful that things would get better. When you've done the practice and each part kind of feels confident in what they're going to sing, and then you run through the whole song a couple of times, top to bottom, it's like a mini performance. It takes me back to happy memories dancing in shows as a kid, and it gave me a feeling of accomplishment. And this kind of made me feel ready to start another week. It reset me. Along with running, being in the choir became my mood booster, and this is what got me through 2020.
My next guest is Carrie Scott. She is an art curator who has her own gallery in central London, Originally from the US, I invited Carrie on to the podcast to talk, as I did with Gemma, about how music and art can be soothing for the soul during times of great stress and trouble. We do talk about that, but I also asked Carrie about her career into the world of art and how she got going. It's absolutely fascinating. I always say on these podcasts, whenever there's somebody who's in an industry I know nothing about, of which there are many, I'm always intrigued and quite nosy. So welcome, Carrie, and thanks for agreeing to come on the show. I have never actually asked you how you got into your career. If you could explain what you do.
What I do is about the hardest question to start with. Only because I came into the art world not in a linear fashion at all. I wanted to be a writer my whole life. I graduated from university. I landed a job with Condé Nast. I was 21 living in New York, and I was like, I've got it made. So I was working for them and I was doing all their, I was basically getting all the content web ready and writing headlines, and it was fast track to being part of the magazine. And then that was May of 2001. And obviously then September of 2001 was a disaster in New York, right? The trade towers were hit. And, you know, I was a kid and this massive thing happened. And I don't mind admitting that it freaked me out. Big, big, big time freaked me out. And it made me question what I was doing, why I was doing it, and like, what was the point of this life I was living, which was pretty cutthroat, pretty surface. And this feels like the most, I mean, it feels like it's rehearsed because, but I promise it's not. I ended up going to galleries.
As a kind of soul soothing thing, you mean?
Yeah. And I wasn't aware of that, right? I was young enough that we were broke. So what could we do? Galleries were free. At Condé, we had memberships to all the big museums in New York. So MoMA, Whitney, and the Met, we had memberships to. It was just a benefit. And I mean, I honestly, by the end of the following spring, I was on first name basis with the guards at MoMA. I'd just go there instead of like going to a bar and drinking endlessly.
Like all other 20-year-olds.
Exactly. Especially in New York. I just found being in those spaces made me feel better.
And what do you think it was about that that made you feel better?
Well, that's a complicated question, right? And when I have thought about, so there are amazing studies. University of Toronto, for instance, analyzed sort of 15 studies with a neuroscientist explaining that like the areas of the brain involved in processing emotion and those that are activated with all that pleasure reward stuff, they're engaged when we're looking at art.
So there's an actual scientific basis behind why it's pleasing and pleasurable.
Exactly. You know, and so even if you're not thinking about the artwork critically, this study showed that like the essential parts of the brain that are associated with contemplation are automatically sparked when you're looking at an artwork. And that's amazing, right? It's a phenomenal thing. And so there is just a ton of increasing scientific evidence that proves art enhances sort of brain function, nervous system, all that stuff.
Because I guess it's slightly linked, you know, it's almost meditative to some people to go around a gallery and just peacefully look at these artworks. I'm assuming you're not got two kids and in train who are just tearing around like lunatics at this point.
No, thank goodness.
So fast forward kind of 20 years and you have a gallery in London.
Yeah. In the middle of all that, I sort of decided, okay, I'll go to grad school and I'll write about travel from an art perspective. And that seemed like a really obvious thing to do. I still was like, I'm going to be a writer. And I happened to end up at the University of Washington in Seattle. I kind of wanted to get as far away from New York as humanly possible.
Yeah. Well, short of leaving the country, that is as far as you can get.
Exactly. And Seattle was a super special place to be. I mean, it's still a super special place, but it was amazing. You know, I was in grad school, I was meeting incredible people who were really embedded in the art community. And I happened upon an internship with a couple called Bill and Ruth True, who had a collection an amazing collection, one of the best video collections at the time, maybe still. And they were putting it on public view, but in this very private way, in a warehouse that was half a domestic space and half a gallery space. I then quickly got introduced to a man called James Harris, who had a teeny gallery space-wise, but had huge ambition about what he wanted to do. And honestly, it was like one of the best working relationships of my career, honestly, still to date. I mean, it was a true collaboration, and he really trusted me, and he taught me how to, you know, put polyfiller in a wall, how to pack artwork, how to fix artwork.
And he took a punt on you, because I'm guessing you hardly had any experience at this time.
I mean, hardly any, right? And I was just this sort of academic person who's a bit lost still, right? I was trying to find my way. We just had this beautiful relationship. And then we did a big show together with a young emerging artist called Rashid Johnson, who's now a household name. And from that, I got recruited to go run a gallery in New York. And I left biting my nails. And when I tell you my relationship with New York is so complicated, it's because when I got back there, that was 2007, and within a heartbeat, it was 2008, and the world was falling apart again.
Of course. Oh my God. Yeah.
And so then at that point, I thought, you know what? I don't have a husband. I don't have kids. I'm not yet 30. I'm just going to try and do this on my own. And I'm going to do the thing that I love most about this industry. And that was really helping artists to do what they love. And when I say to do, I mean literally to help them raise funds and then monetize their creativity. And I mean, I set up my business with zero plan and no money. And my parents kept saying, "You're still in debt from grad school. Are you crazy?" And on a wing and a prayer, away we go. And, you know, still standing 11 years later.
So, but what do you think it was that drove you? Because I mean, a lot of people would just, you know, the sort of stepping off into the unknown. Art is notoriously difficult to make it in any sense. And I can imagine, especially if you've got a lot of debt behind you and, you know, it sounded like, with all due respect, Harry, you were quite mobile, let's say. It's not like you had a particular calling to any particular city, but you clearly had a vision of what you wanted to create somewhere.
I think I just knew, and it's still the same. I know how it makes me feel when I pull something off on behalf of someone else, right? And I do, I can remember I can remember being a kid and being sort of wandering around the Wallace collection and just being in awe of these objects and what they meant and what the artist was trying to do, and just feeling this like profound respect for, I guess, this notion that like what artists, why do they make art? Making art isn't easy. There's other ways to communicate your idea that are more simple. And in fact, right, the starving artist is more common than the successful. So it just, I guess it felt really important. It still feels important, and it still feels like a massive privilege. And I still get such a huge high when I sell something, or a brand picks something up, or a show comes together and someone walks in and is like, wow, this has changed me. I feel different now from being here and looking at this.
So that's really, I suppose, the crux of what I wanted to talk to you about how, without sounding too grandiose, but you know, life-changing art can be, and especially during times of sadness or stress or pandemic. And has your relationship with art and what you do changed during the pandemic, or have you, in terms of what you're doing and your message, has it been a positive thing? Have you been able to get it out more? Is there more demand for art, I guess, when the world is going to hell in a handbasket?
It's been it's almost like I see a disaster and I'm like, okay, I don't want to say the word pivot, but just naturally, there has been this amazing thing that's happened with my business in terms of how I behave online. So, you know, whereas I used to put up an exhibition and then I'd send out a mailer and I'd send out a press release and I'd ask people to come and see the show, it became apparent quite quickly that that wouldn't be possible. So video made sense.
Video exhibitions, or are you showing clients around?
Kind of all of the above. So we launched a show on Harold Feinstein's work, who's a long forgotten street photographer from the 1950s, right before lockdown. And his work is really life-affirming. It is quite literally life-affirming. I mean, he found beauty in everybody and everything. It didn't matter how old, how young, how fat, how thin, what color they were. And obviously for the 1950s, that's extraordinary in and of itself. But we were, you know, it was a shock to have to shutter the gallery and not be able to share his work, especially someone who we were trying to sort of excavate and tell this story and bring a renaissance to. But halfway through lockdown, I stumbled upon some audio of him walking around his own exhibition in the 80s at Penn State. And he's talking to curators and he's explaining the work to them and narrating it. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me and David Hill, who I launched that show with, that there was something in this and that we should illustrate it. So quite simply, we like sat down. We knew obviously the images he was talking about, and we made this little audio slideshow from this forgotten document. And that was, I mean, people loved it.
You're bringing it to them, making it more accessible.
Exactly. And it's one of the things that I've slightly fought against in my career is this white cube concept, which can be quite alienating for so many people. And I use the example of the Wallace because I think that is a space you go to and you don't feel intimidated by the work. But if you go into Hauser, it's the most beautiful space, and it is, you know, a massive, minimal monument to art, but it's intimidating for lots of people. So to be able to just put out a video and say to anyone, you can watch this, you can engage with me if you feel like it, you also don't have to. This is just sheer pleasure, research, enjoy. And I loved doing that, right? Like the art historian in me remembered a part of myself that I've put aside because of my need to commercialize the business and monetize the business. So we followed that formula and did the same thing for our next show, which is on West African portraiture. And we did like a trailer. I mean, we got really into it. So like a 60-second sizzle that you could see before the film opened, and then a 15-minute film giving context, like a historical context for what it was to be in West Africa, again, 1950s, 60s, and what it would have, what emerged from there post-independence. And again, it was just this really fun thing for us to do. You know, like clients in LA saw it.
So you, all of a sudden, you're opening your world up to a huge, well, global audience and bringing, yeah, this idea of bringing art to them, to their houses, I suppose.
Absolutely. And when everyone is yearning to go out and see things and do things, it felt a bit like we were doing something good for people.
Yeah. So do you think, will you continue to do things? I mean, when things open up, will you do both? I'm sure people still want to go and actually look at the art and be around these great pieces. But do you think it's changed? Has the pandemic changed the way people access art?
It'll certainly change the way that I do business, because it did remind me of that thing that's inherent in me. Like, the, you know, I'm staring at a book that's on my desk next to me now, which is Women in Photography in Africa. I haven't read it yet. The show's over. There's no reason that I should read this, but I'll read it because I'm going to love it. And I've remembered that, like, academic person who likes the writing, who gets a buzz off excavating stories, if you will. And I think I feel better. So frankly, I'm just going to keep doing it.
That's as good a reason as any. So I just want to touch briefly upon this idea that art is a kind of good for the soul. And with all your knowledge, I know nothing about art, but I know what I like, I know what I enjoy. And certainly, you know, there is some, it just makes you feel peaceful if you find that, you know, particular image is, you know, we're so aesthetically driven. It's just, I guess, some questions to you personally. How have you used art during this very stressful time to kind of calm the soul?
So I have a work by an artist called Storm Tharp, and I'm getting like choked up, and I can hear, you know, my voice has changed because I'm about to wax poetic about it. It's the outlayer in our collection. My husband actually was brave enough to buy it for me for my 40th. And Storm is someone that I've known since those Seattle days, sort of 20 years ago. And it is this really abstract mountain. It's a monolith. I normally like figurative work. I don't really like abstract work. That's not what I'm drawn to naturally. But it's this big yellow blob, for lack of a better word. I promise you, I look at it every day and touch base with it. It's like a marker or a beacon or it's like a grounding, oh, it's there. And it kind of reminds me, I guess, that there is always a before, there's always an after. We just have to go through it.
I love that.
And he made the series. It was actually based on Matt Moon's and Hilton's Lost Horizons, right? So this idea, like a Shangri-La, a paradise that doesn't exist, but does exist in the writer's mind. And he then borrowed on that. And it was all a part of his pain in dealing with politics and unrest in the States a couple years ago. And obviously now that has escalated, but I didn't know any of that, right? My husband bought the piece. It came to me. I fell in love with it. But then I wrote to him and said, listen, it's so weird. I'm literally every day like checking in with you. And it makes me feel, you know, I feel better. And we had this crazy conversation where he was like, yeah, it's a Shangri-La. And I was like, wait, like Hilton's Lost Horizon, the book. I mean, it's a crazy book that then was turned into a film. And yeah, it was, it was nuts to me that he obviously was painting that consciously. And I was getting that, this idea of a place to escape to from a blob of yellow.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you very much, Carrie. How can people find out more about you? We'll put links to the various pieces that you've talked about in the show notes. But if people want to follow you on Instagram or find out more about your work.
Easiest way is always the gram, right? Which is CEA Scott with two T's. And yeah, my website is forever changing and trying to show things. But I'm thrilled. I really am. I don't think as a society that we talk enough about how important art and culture generally are. And if you look at the way, you know, governments nationwide have ignored art and culture, it's really nice to have been invited on to speak about how important it is.
Huge thanks to Gemma and to Carrie for talking about music and art, its impact on us all, and their thoughts about it during the pandemic. As I talked about at the top of the show, I'm going to take a few weeks off just to be with my family, but we'll be back, I hope, in January. I have mentioned on LinkedIn that we are looking for a sponsor. If you or somebody you know would be interested in sponsoring this podcast, please do drop me an email, jane@careeringintomotherhood.com. And in the meantime, have a lovely Christmas and all the best for a peaceful 2021.